Well, welcome. I knew this morning when the baby cried at 6:30 and I slipped on a disused bottle of milk and hit my head on the kitchen floor that it was going to be one of those days, and it has for me ever since. So I'm not at all surprised that all the guests are not yet assembled, but I'm sure Kevin Watkins from Oxfam is on his way, and I look forward to welcoming him when he comes. He's an important member of the panel because he has some contrasting views to the two people who I'm going to introduce in a moment. So let's hope he comes. But if he doesn't come, we'll find a way of managing without him. So welcome this evening. Today's debate is on global governance and global justice. It's the first in a series of joint events being organized by the LSE and the World Economic Forum under the sign of Davos, entitled Leadership, Management, and Governance. A series of discussions and debates is to be held at the LSE over the coming year, and the series is designed to bring together expertise from both organizations alongside other specialists in an open forum where questions affecting us all can be discussed in a public context. And of course, there are a few more important topics than that today. I very much hope these debates will also draw in a diverse range of campaigners and activists. The LSE must be at the center of debate, engaging the widest spectrum of views. The LSE would not be in the right place if it didn't try to bring together, as it were, the opposing spectrum of voices you hear both at Davos and at Porto Alegre. Tonight's procedures, at least the plan was, that each speaker would speak for 15 minutes. Then each speaker would have 5 minutes to comment on each other's contributions, and then the floor would be opened to you. And we will see how that progresses in light of the position of our third guest. Let me just introduce the three, and hope that then when Kevin sits down, you'll know who he is. The first speaker this evening is Anne Florini. She's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and director of the current World Economic Forum's Global Governance Initiative, about which you'll hear more in a moment. And she's the author of The Coming Democracy, New Rules for Running a New World. Do you want to hold it up, Anne, so people can see it's real and it exists? An ambitious title, New Rules. Richard Sammons is managing director of the World Economic Forum, a Geneva-based foundation. He's responsible for the development and management of all the forum's major initiatives and task forces, and he helped structure the global issues program of the forum's annual meeting in Davos and regional meetings. And I would like to congratulate him on that in many ways. I've been going to Davos for 2 years, and I have to say, I'm extremely impressed by the quality of discussions and the diversity of views that one hears. As I was invited once for the first time, I arrived somewhat skeptically, and I was very impressed by the general quality of discussion and the trouble it's taken at Davos to bring in very different voices. I have to say that surprised me, but it's an impressive feat and deserves, I think, more recognition than it gets. But before joining the forum, he served as a special assistant to the President for the International Economic Policy at the White House and assisted President Clinton on a broad range of international trade and financial policy matters. Finally, Kevin Watkins, where are you? An impressive guy too. He is the head of research at Oxfam, and I think Oxfam do a fantastic job in general terms. His publications include the Oxfam Poverty Report, Economic Growth and Equity, the Oxfam Education Report, and an international key report on international trade published a couple of years ago or so called Rigged Rules and Double Standards. I think it's probably one of the most important contributions to debate about world trade. An extremely impressive document, and coming from an NGO at the time, a very vital contribution to debate about trade, fair trade, rigged rules, hypocrisy in trading discussions and negotiations. He's also written extensively, and you might see his name in the press because he writes often on social and economic policy. So that is the panel, potentially of three, certainly of two, me and others if necessary, and all of you will have to work harder if Kevin doesn't come. He's coming. Do we know where? 1 minute. Excellent. So if you've come over very slowly to the podium, He'll be here by then. Okay, so join with me for welcoming two and soon three members of the panel.
Thank you, David. I will start off by speaking slowly in hopes that Kevin arrives in time to hear what I'm saying.
He has arrived.
And he has. Welcome. I'm going to be talking about both of the publications that David mentioned, primarily about the World Economic Forum report that I think most of you have copies of. I've seen a lot of you flipping through it while we were gathering. And at the end, just a little bit about the book that Kevin mentioned on global governance, because they're really both about the same general sets of themes. We need to start by thinking about why is it that we talk about global governance at all? And it's simply because there is a huge agenda of global problems, problems that can't be solved by our usual national channels of decision-making acting independently of each other. It's a litany that I think is familiar to everyone here. There's the dire poverty that afflicts such a large proportion of the world's population. The latest figures are 1.2 billion people living on a dollar a day or less, almost half the world's population living on $2 a day or less. There's the increasingly evident problem of climate change, with glaciers retreating and permafrost melting throughout the Arctic tundra. There is the capacity of what New York Times columnist Tom Friedman refers to as the super empowered individuals to do harm in the world, something we saw extremely dramatically on September 11th. There is the whole set of issues around global public health, everything from AIDS to SARS to the whole spread of diseases around the world, which in an era of global travel are clearly not problems for individual nations to handle by themselves. All of these require a degree of cooperation to solve. But if you spend some time looking at what is it the world is actually doing about these problems, you begin to develop a somewhat uneasy feeling, particularly if you're looking primarily at governments, which is the set of actors that we usually think about when we're thinking about how do you do global governance. There's quite a bit of bad news out there. But there's also some good news out there, news about what civil society organizations are doing, what increasingly the private sector is trying to do, and what both of these sets of actors are doing in collaboration with governments to try to get a handle on coping with some of the global challenges that we face. Which one's winning? Is the world going to hell in a handbasket? Or is there actually enough good news out there that some of these global problems are going to be solved? How do you know the answer to that? There isn't anybody out there who has been systematically looking at what is it that the world needs to do in order to solve these problems across the board, and how hard is it trying? And that's what the Global Governance Initiative, the project of the World Economic, launched by the World Economic Forum, is setting out to do. What we did was take a set of goals that have been agreed upon by the world's governments on everything from peace and security to poverty to hunger alleviation to education, health, human rights, and the environment, and look across the board at how hard are we actually trying to achieve those goals. The goals in some cases are very clear and specific. Have the proportion of people living in poverty by the year 2015. In some cases, they're very broad. Save our people, free our peoples from the scourge of war. But there are enough of those goals out there, and there's enough specifics that you can draw on that you can actually start thinking about how do you hold the world accountable for whether, in fact, it is really trying to achieve those goals. If you look at the set of goals as a whole, they make a pretty logical agenda for what the world ought to be trying to do if, in fact, we're interested in global justice, human dignity for all. Many of them are not terribly ambitious. Having the proportion of people living in poverty by the year 2015 is still going to leave 900 million people living on a dollar a day or less. But it would be an improvement over where we are now. To do the project, we set up expert groups in each of these issue areas, drawing on the best people we could find in the world, whose job it was not to tell us what to do, but to look at what did the world do in calendar year 2003. And on a 0 to 10 scale, give the world a grade. The world looking largely not just at governments, but at intergovernmental organizations, the private sector, and civil society. Look at what they're doing. And compare that to some reasonable estimate of what would be needed for us to have done in the year 2003 if we were serious about achieving these goals. The findings have just come out. The executive summary is the document that I think most of you have had a chance to look at, and I think there are more in the back if you haven't. And let me give you just a couple of minutes of highlights of what the findings were of that report. On peace and security, there's actually some surprisingly good news. If you look at trends over the last decade or so, there has been a remarkable improvement in the world's capacity to deal with civil conflicts and internal violence. The trend is way down from where it was a decade ago. And in fact, the year 2003 brought some very good news in that there were no new civil wars, and several of the most intractable conflicts actually saw some real progress. The Congo, Liberia, Sudan. There is good news on the proliferation front that came at the very end of the year with the agreement with Libya to give up weapons of mass destruction programs. But in the opinion of the expert group that we put together, this was overshadowed by other events in the year. As you might guess, Iraq had a lot to do with what they were thinking about. And it wasn't so much that the fact that there was a war counted against the world's grid on peace and security as the way in which the decision to go to war was made. We do have an international system in place with all its problems for determining whether war should happen or not, and that system failed. No matter which side you were on that debate, there is no question that the system broke down, did not work, and there are serious questions about where that system is going to go in the future. In addition, on the peace and security front, there was a total lack of progress in one of the issues that probably kills more people than any interstate war has done in a very long time, which is the traffic in small arms. Zero progress on that. But controlling the illicit trade in small arms is one of the avowed goals of the international community. It's not really doing very much. And not nearly enough effort went into combating terrorism, despite all the rhetoric and the flurry of apparent activity on that front. So the score the Peace and Security Group came up with for the world as a whole for calendar year 2003 was a 3 on a 0 to 10 scale. Since 10 only represents what the world would do if it were serious about being on track, not necessarily finally achieving the goals, a 3 is a pretty dismal score. I'm going to spend a lot less time on some of the others. If you look at the set of development goals across the board, the health, education, and particularly poverty reduction and hunger reduction, all of the expert groups in those areas gave a 3 or a 4. It's a dismal grade for what we are actually doing on the development front. A lot of this, particularly on hunger and poverty reduction, had to do with the disaster at Cancun. There was an opportunity there for the world to make truly significant progress on reducing agricultural subsidies and opening markets for the agricultural exports of the poor countries, and the rich countries simply failed, utterly and absolutely failed, for which they need to be held accountable. Across the board on development issues, there have been an enormous number of promises of new resources flooding in, but for the most part, the promises are not yet matched in full by the resources that would need that have been promised. And even if the promises are met in full, it's way below the levels that are probably actually needed if we wanted to solve the problems and achieve the goals. To give just one example, on education, there's a fast-track initiative on education where the rich countries have promised the poor countries that if the poor country governments come up with good plans on education, the rich countries will see to it that they receive the assistance that they need to get those programs underway and funded. We're not talking about huge quantities of money here. We're talking about a total program of about $300 million. But so far, the rich countries have not even been willing to do that, and there is a shortfall of about $100 million. If those kinds of shortfalls continue on, this isn't just education, that's just one example. But again and again, we see this pattern of promises on development assistance that are not met. Developing country governments that are inspired to go out and try to develop plans so they can get the assistance that they need, when the promises are then not met, a certain amount of cynicism develops on the part of people who had made very serious efforts to figure out how their countries could solve these problems, for which they know they need help from the outside, and they are not getting the levels of help that they need. Finish up by talking a little bit about the environment, which, in my opinion, is the biggest challenge we face of all. The environment group didn't try to look at the whole set of environmental issues for the world. That would be impossible. So they took 3 general proxy issues that would at least give us a good sense of how hard is the international community trying to deal with its well-known environmental problems. So we looked at climate change, we looked at biodiversity, and we looked at water and sanitation. Climate change, of course, there has been remarkably little progress on. European governments have done some good things, but nowhere near what they would need to be doing if they were serious about reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases. They're managing to basically keep them constant. The American government had a shameful record and has had for quite some time. Corporations, with the exception of a few key actors like BP and Shell, who have shown some leadership in the area, have done essentially nothing. Little bits here and there, but essentially nothing, even though it is their actions that often generate many of the greenhouse gases that we're concerned with. The other environmental pictures aren't much better. Biodiversity loss, there is very little serious effort being put into dealing with it. Again, the score was a 3. In fact, across the board, for every single one of these issue areas, even though these expert groups worked independently, never communicated with each other, there were a couple of us who went to all of the meetings, but none of them were communicating with each other, every score came out as a 3 or a 4. That's a shocking condemnation of the international community, because these goals are not wildly optimistic goals. These goals are, in fact, pretty fundamental stepping stones toward what we would need to do if we are serious about making the world a juster and fairer place. In my last couple of minutes, I want to draw a couple of lessons from the Global Governance book, The Coming Democracy, because I wrote the book out of a sense of frustration over exactly this shortfall between rhetoric and reality that's been going on for a very long time. In the 1980s, I worked for a research organization that worked on multilateral issues, as they were then called. We now call them global issues. And I went to one meeting after another where everybody said, if only the government had political will, we could solve all these problems. Well, that's true. But they didn't, and they don't. And there isn't much reason to believe that that is fundamentally going to change anytime in the very near future, especially under business as usual. So I started looking at how is it you either develop political will or work around the governments such that you are not utterly dependent on their political will to solve these problems and to achieve these global goals. I am down to 1 minute, so I'm just going to give you a couple of points.
You can take five.
I can take a couple more?
You're ahead of schedule.
Okay. Good, a little more time. Well, then 1 minute to lay out what the problem is. The problem isn't just that we aren't achieving the goals. The problem is that the processes by which we make decisions about how to achieve these goals or even how to set them are fundamentally undemocratic and fundamentally unfair. For those of you who work on political economy, I'm sure you're familiar with the way it is that decisions get made in institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, where the voting is rigged in favor of the rich and powerful countries to a degree that is actually disproportionate to their economic contributions to those organizations. And yet, when there was a slight effort to change those voting rules so that, for example, the 2 delegates from Africa who have to represent all of Africa, each representing about 25 countries, as opposed to the almost 1 delegate per country of the richer countries, when there was a proposal put forward to increase that number to 3, the United States vetoed it. There is not a lot of receptivity on the part of the rich countries, and this is not just the United States, on the part of the rich countries as a whole, to change those kinds of rules in ways that would give others power that is commensurate with their share of the population or their share of the responsibility for dealing with global problems. It isn't just in the economic area either. Look at the design of the UN Security Council with its veto. These are all institutions that were set up post-1945 reflecting a world that is very, very different from the world that we live in, reflecting a world where the agenda was completely different from the agenda of the world that we live in. And yet there is not much progress being made towards changing those institutions in ways that reflect current realities, and efforts to do those changes, as I just indicated, aren't really going anywhere. There's a lot of talk about it, not a lot of reality. So I started looking at what do you do in other ways. If you can't change the institutions and you can't do a whole lot directly about political will of the government, what can you do? And it seems to me that there are a couple of things that actually give us real reason for hope that there are better ways of going about solving global problems. There are 3 trends that I think really matter. One trend is information technology. If you look, you can look at the numbers, you can just get a sense from what's happened in your own lives over the last 10 years, at just what has happened with information technology, the world is tied together. Information flows are happening in ways that were inconceivable 20 years ago. And even though there is still a big north-south divide on information technology, it is already the case that people, ordinary people in developing countries, have much more opportunity to find out what's going on in the world, to find out what's going on in their own communities, and to have some way of getting their voices out and voices heard than has ever been the case before. There is no end to that in sight. The second trend is the growth of civil society around the world. As people are becoming better informed and more tied in, they're organizing themselves at an escalating rate. You can see graphs of what's happened to the level of formal civil society organizations over the last several years, and it's like the charts on information technologies. The curves go like that. And that barely begins to give a sense of just how strong the phenomenon is, because most of these groups are not registered or not easy to track. But civil society organization has taken off in almost all parts of the world. Again, it is not just a northern phenomenon. Last trend that I think gives us hope is the development of a norm, an idea about transparency. And it's an idea that any concentration of power, whether it's a government or a business or an intergovernmental organization like the IMF or the World Bank, has an obligation to report on itself to outsiders so that those outsiders can hold it accountable for what it does. There's been some backtracking on that in the last couple of years, but overall, if you look at the trends, say 50 years ago and today, 50 years ago, there were two countries that had something that you could recognize as a Freedom of Information Act. Now there are over 50, and the number is escalating. 50 years ago, the idea that you would give out any information about your military policies and plans would have been seen as treasonous. Now it is common among countries that used to be adversaries. On the environmental front, requiring people to release information about their environmental impact is the new wave of environmental regulation. And when people do that, they get put in a position of having to improve their environmental performance, or the local communities come down on them like a ton of bricks. Last minute, if you take those trends and put them together, and you look at how transparency and information technology and civil society are interacting in all of the issue areas that we're talking about in the Global Governance Initiative, in all of them, there is enormous progress being made through civil society, through transparency, through access to information that did not used to exist. This is not something that can fully compensate for the lack of political will on the part of governments, but in fact, what it can help to do is contribute to the development of that political will, and in the meantime, it is at least a stopgap way for making progress. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Happy to be here, and want to articulate a note of appreciation to LSE and to David for embarking on this public discussion series with us at the World Economic Forum. We are hopeful that this will be stimulating for you and us, and will carry us into some interesting territory intellectually. What I would like to do simply at the outset is to indicate that we should probably put a little disclaimer caveat on some of the discussion today. We're really here in our personal capacities. The Global Governance Initiative indeed itself isn't so much an institutional, it's not a forum policy pronouncement, because the forum as a forum doesn't take institutional positions. It's not like a Chamber of Commerce, which is a business representative organization. It's more of a platform for discussion and some common work. And the Global Governance Initiative is one example of collective or collaborative work by not only the business community, which makes up the, strictly speaking, membership of the forum, but organizations from different elements of the international system. And we are announcing, in fact, next week in Davos, that we are organizing our portfolio of these kinds of initiatives into a newly created Global Institute for Partnership and Governance, basically an organizational platform that'll improve our capacity to act as an informal hopefully independent platform for engaging business with other stakeholders on three types of collaborative initiatives. One is trying to mobilize action on the ground, and we have a few in that area. Another is improving governance, and I think the Global Governance Initiative fits principally in that bucket. And then lastly, informal dialogue. There is an increasing demand, given the elevated importance of transnational actors like the business community, like civil society, to work together, in part because some of these issues, some of these global issues, are so big, so complex, that they implicate different stakeholders beyond the official sector. And as we all know, particularly those of us who've been in government, it's often very difficult to get a multidimensional discussion going because of protocol and other considerations, and it's in an official structure. And also because the official community is divided, as so much of our professional lives are, into specialization, into specialties, professional domains. And so that's what we hope to provide a little bit at the forum going forward. Now, what I would like to do is just spend a minute or two making some overarching comments about the Global Governance Initiative's findings. This group of over 40 experts who've worked over the last year and overseen by a fairly large steering committee. And then I'd like to maybe move the discussion a little bit into the terrain of what we should be doing from my personal perspective. First, I think it's worth noting at the outset that the Millennium Declaration associated goals are pretty remarkable. I think there's a fair amount of cynicism out there that their rhetoric, they're soaring and reaching types of goals. But if you think about it, they are a remarkable expression on a consensual basis of the global public interest, at least for the next couple of decades. And that's no small feat. I think the United Nations system, for all of its warts and difficulties, you got to give them some credit for spending the time and actually getting to at least some level of agreement on some norms and some goals. Secondly, what our project was intended to do is to try to set up an independent process, to be a watchdog, to take a hard look at the gap between what we call aspiration and action. Because those goals, while important, as I've just said, are just that, they're aspiration. And what really counts is whether there's follow-through. We try to do so by effectively, although we don't necessarily call it this technically, setting up kind of a peer review mechanism on a global scale. To try to bring some moral suasion to bear on all of us. And I think I'd like to emphasize for a second the phrase on all of us. Traditional notions of global governance tend to focus on intergovernmental structures, agreements, etc. And what we've deliberately tried to do with this initiative is to lead a thought process which helps us to expand our sense of global governance beyond the official sector. Yes, the official sector has principal responsibility for most of what is laid out in this expression of the global public interest in the Millennium Declaration related goals. But as I said before, many of these issues, some of the biggest potential opportunities for progress lie at the intersection, frankly, of some of these stakeholder segments, between the intersection of private sector and the official sector, intersection of civil society and the private sector, et cetera. And so what this group is doing is looking not just at the performance of the system or the degree of effort by the official, the traditional actors, but also by these newly active, if I could say, transnational actors that are non-governmental, like the business community and civil society. So in a sense, this initiative is exploring whether, in fact, there is a new multilateralism that is brewing. Multilateralism, usually hotly debated in the papers today, think is mainly about official architecture. But in fact, I think we're beginning to see much more engagement by private sector, civil society, making a dent, making an impact on different issues, and shuffling the deck a bit in the way the world goes about governing itself on some of these cross-national issues. And then the last kind of overarching point I guess I would want to make before getting into some of the implications of all this is that what we're kind of exploring here is the potential ground for global citizenship. We all feel, well, not all of us, I suppose, it depends where you what your political views are and what countries you're in and what your historical context is. But there's a much stronger sense of citizenship relative to your community or your nation than there certainly is at this stage of the game to global issues. And this report, by trying to hold all of us to task on some of these globally articulated consensual goals, is in a sense appealing to the potential for a broader sense of global citizenship. And indeed, that's one of the basic missions of this new institute we're creating, is to set up multi-stakeholder partnerships that explore areas that can try to inspire a greater sense of engagement and global citizenship. Now, so much for the kind of overarching comments about our project and whatnot. Let me speak a bit from personal experience about, I guess, what will cover five of the seven groups. It won't really cover peace and security or human rights, but more the environmental and economic related issues. Why so little effort? Why barely a third of what really needs to be done for us to be on track, is what our experts collectively found over the past year. Well, you know, often people say there's a lack of resources. I'm personally a little bit dubious of that, but that comes up. Secondly, very often people point to poor domestic governance. You know, global governance depends on good domestic governance, or the agglomeration of good domestic governance. And the absence of it in many areas dissipates effort and undermines political support for action at a more global level. More interesting from my perspective is a lack of coherence. And by that I mean at two levels, across portfolios, because as I mentioned earlier, it's just the way humans organize their work, by and large, that we're encouraged to specialize. I mean, we're here in an august institution of higher learning, and you are all in basically studying your disciplines and getting deeper and deeper expertise in them, and there are great incentives in the job market for you to deepen that expertise. It's natural. But in a lot of these issues that we're tackling in this report, a lot of the big global issues are very interdisciplinary. They can't really be solved in one discipline. In many cases, they really need much greater engagement across governmental portfolios. And that our institutional structures are really not well suited to it. But there's another dimension, I think, of the lack of coherence, and this is the multi-stakeholder issue, the new way of looking at multilateralism. There are these pitfalls of us not integrating the private sector and civil society and other elements of society, science, more with the official structure process. Further, other potential reasons, I guess, from my thinking why there's so little effort is there's a lack of a kind of a democratic or political push to enforce accountability for some of these cross-national or overarching global goals. There is no global polity yet. We don't, as I said earlier, we don't really feel like we're all part of the same kind of political system with the same kinds of norms and whatnot. There isn't this well-articulated or well-developed sense of global citizenship. In the States, in politics, it's an adage that all politics is local. And there, they really mean local. But they're also really not very well elaborated transnational institutions through which popular will that cuts across countries can be well articulated, some of what Anne was talking about before. And in the face of some of these structural issues, there hasn't been very much leadership, let's be frank about it, without the bottom-up political push. No major grouping of important governments has made addressing these issues in some systemic fashion an organizing principle of their governmental agenda. I can say that about my government. I can say that about even the administration I served in and the party that I served for many years. And as impressed as I am with the leadership here over the last several years, the same can be said there. And I guess part of what that leads me to think is that part of the lack of leadership or the lack of imagination on this issue stems from the failure to appreciate, in my view, that there is a strong parallel between the process that many advanced industrialized countries went through over maybe 100 years ago or so, for 150 to 50 years ago, where there was quite a debate during this period about trying to expand the benefits, participation in the benefits of the growth that technology and market principles was creating. Economic systems need the right incentives for growth, but at the same time, we know that markets overshoot. There's a lot of volatility involved. But it isn't appropriate, I think we feel at this stage of the game, for people's livelihoods to be subject to the same kind of volatility as asset prices. Similarly, markets, while an incredibly good organizing principle for growth, often leave behind, their impact on standards of living is quite uneven. There are many times that pockets of populations are left aside. These were big issues. To some extent, they're still important issues in advanced industrialized countries. And it led to a bottom-up political push for what? It wasn't, yes, transfer payments were important, shock absorbers of those things, what we call in a global context aid. But I think what really made the difference was institutional development. Basically, what helped the middle class to share in the benefits of growth and what helped to dissipate what was a tendency for wealth to be concentrated was the build-out of institutions in the financial arena, financial governance and regulatory institutions, labor institutions, environmental institutions, consumer safety and health institutions, the antitrust institutions, both the law and the institutional enforcement mechanisms and capacity to enforce these rules. It was this process of institutional development in many of the developed countries, like I say, 50, 75, 100 years ago, which really kick-started the broadening of participation in the benefits of economic growth. Now, you can say in recent decades that maybe there's been some progress about this at the international level, but I would argue by and large, we haven't yet had absorbed into our leadership circles here, or in the popular imagination, the parallel here, the need for some sort of a parallel process to occur at the international level, and then to think about what needs to occur through international coordination, particularly among the countries that have have expertise and resources to make it happen. Now, the Washington Consensus, yes, is its primacy certainly has receded in recent years. This so-called consensus, and the poor guy who really coined the term, didn't really feel like he was promoting it, but he was just describing what was essentially a few basic principles about good macroeconomic policy, an open economy, etc. And it is true that the self-confidence of that perspective is much diminished in recent years. But it is also true that what will replace it is an open question. But what I see a little bit is some encouraging news in this regard. And I understand that, Professor Held, you've been writing about this, so maybe this will provoke you to have some thoughts on it later. But clearly people recognize that there needs to be some thought given to institution building in some of these other areas. Because you can't think only about the growth side of the equation, which is what the Washington Consensus was mainly focused on. You need also to think about the compositional aspect of economic policy and what instruments are available to try to broaden participation in the benefits for standards of living that growth creates. And here, although we don't talk about it in these terms, the new debates about capacity building, the new debates about sequencing financial liberalization in countries, the new debates about, even in the Doha round, we see fits and starts about this issue. Developing countries have rightly put on the table that, hey, you can't expect us to undertake obligations if A, we lack the capacity to really negotiate this stuff on an equal footing with developed countries because we don't have the expert analysis and bureaucracies to support our negotiators, but B, even more importantly, we don't have the productive capacity in many respects to take advantage of the opening that the trade agreements creates in certain markets. And you have to look at these institution building issues alongside the growth agenda of lowering barriers to trade, getting macroeconomic policy right, et cetera. So I think there's some glimmers of hope that we're beginning to move a bit in our conception about a framework for global governance, for a process that can encourage some greater absorption of global goals within our traditional approaches to these issues on the economic policy side. But I think what I would like to do is maybe end with a few specific thoughts that, despite these glimmers of hope that I'm seeing, which are more at a kind of an analytical level, I think it's still fair to say, as the experts from this initiative concluded, that there's woeful little effort and progress being made. And so what do you do when you've got these constraints about possible lack of resources, a lack of coherence, a lack of a democratic push from the bottom up through structures that can make the people who do influence the agendas of their government respond? What do you do in that situation? I think the only thing you can do is innovate. Basically try to innovate within and around these constraints, and indeed try to change them, try to change the assumptions themselves in a few areas. And let me just spend a couple of minutes ticking off a few things that, based on my experience, we ought to consider. And this is no mean an exhaustive list, and I don't have the time really to build on these too much, but just for the purposes of discussion, let me put a few down on the table. On the coherence side, and institution building, I have been struck, as a guy who's been working, advising for most of my career in the U.S., Democratic politicians who have a progressive instinct on the one hand, but on the other hand are representing people really on the front lines of economic change. By that I mean workers in the manufacturing sector, in the tradable goods sector, and small farmers. And it's a tough process for these folks to work through of what's the intersection of good policy on the one hand and good politics, keeping in mind that all politics is local, on the other. And just to give you one example of this, inevitably, I mean, we all know that that labor and environmental issues are a highly, highly controversial issue in the trade arena. There have been a couple attempts to try to put it on the WTO agenda. Extremely, I mean, almost toxic issue for many, many, many countries. And usually the argument goes, well, those issues are best left to the specialty institutions like the ILO and the International Environmental Institutions, principally UNEP, but others as well. And if there are problems, they should be strengthened. But I defy anybody to tell me where there's a serious policy process underway to develop an agenda to actually strengthen these institutions in any specific manner. I haven't seen it, and I've been involved in these issues for quite some time. Similarly, on the domestic institutional capacity building level, there's, as I said, been identified over the years a disconnect between what is being sought in the multilateral trading system on the one hand and the resources that have been available for trade institutional capacity building in developing countries on the other. Again, even in Doha, it was flagged as an important issue. But if you look at the actual follow-through, if you look at the resources dedicated to this issue, they've been paltry relative to the need. And it doesn't get enough attention because it's not as sexy as some of the other trade issues, but it's a serious, serious issue. On accountability, well, before I say that, I happen to believe that the only way you're going to solve some of these coherence issues is to do a couple of things. One is to get some of the ministries talking to each other much more. Basically, trade ministers speak to trade ministers, environment ministers meet with environment ministers, labor ministers meet with labor ministers. There's no institutional mechanism to get these people feeling that they have a common work plan. Secondly, the Bretton Woods institutions act the same way. By and large, they operate in their own domains. They're accountable to the trade ministers for the WTO. They're accountable to the finance ministers if you're the bank and the fund. And there's really no higher political level like we're used to at a national basis of an individual who's more broadly accountable, who has a feel for and a responsibility for more than one jurisdiction, and who has more direct accountability to people who cast votes. That's a big lack. And a couple of possible ways one could go about doing that, from my perspective, is to take the G8, expand it into a more representative group, give it as one of its responsibilities the stewardship of these institutions, the international economic institutions. And while that isn't going to solve anything in a fell swoop, because we all know that G8s are long on promises and relatively short on follow-through, at least those individuals are closer to the elected populations, the people who cast votes, and at least they are responsible for more than just one portfolio in this case. And I would add to that, just as a final thought or two, Right now, the bank and the fund and the WTO basically do their own analytical process, their own agenda setting. There's very, very little coordination among them in any serious manner. And part of that is that the UN system doesn't have the juice, doesn't really have the authority to make that happen. However, if you had a leader level process like this, G8 plus or some G20 something plus, you could conceivably require the heads of these three Bretton Woods institutions to do a report every year together, where they have to sign it together and talk about how the world economy did measured against some basic goals about growth, equity, standards of living progress, et cetera, and have them open up or have an important reporting process to the leaders of some reasonably representative group of governments on that to improve their accountability to the leaders of these governments. But then I would add that they should be accountable as a group, again, on the road, at least a couple of public hearings a year in different parts of the world where they, on this basis, are like in a national public hearing, if you will, that many legislatures have to do this. And lastly, maybe what I would suggest on the accountability level is that, you know, a few years back, the World Bank held a very interesting program. It was a one-off, though, as far as I know, and that is, it was called Voices of the Poor, in which they took some of the senior bank management, brought them out of Washington, and brought them on a program in villages where they talked for a while. I mean, really, not just a quick meeting, you know, with the staff and everything, but really had them take some time at the village level and talk to people on the front lines of change and development. And reportedly, this had some significant impact on some of these folks who basically get their analysis filtered through analysts who are overscheduled and who lose, by definition, because of the specialization, because of the press of work, they lose a little bit of the political context, the human context for their work. I would suggest that we consider expanding that to G7 finance ministers, some other leaders, the heads of some of the other institutions, and make it a permanent program. I'm not suggesting any of these things are panaceas, but I'm offering them as suggestions for how we can begin to think about breaking down some of the silos, the coherence issues, trying to juice up a little bit the accountability issue, and also to try to get people thinking in a more integrated fashion about some of these issues. So with that, let me stop and allow the program to move on.
Thank you. I'd like to just start by way of an apology on a governance issue, which is an apology for being late, which is purely a result of weak governance on the Oxford to Paddington railway line and a failure of the public-private partnership in that area. And on another governance question, David actually passed me a note while I was waiting to speak, and I guess it was a secret note, and so in the interest of transparency and accountability, I'd like to share it with you all. And it was basically asking me to be a bit provocative. So I will try to be a little bit provocative, at least. Let me start with an observation. Richard started by saying, and I think he's right, that the framework that's been adopted in the context of the Millennium Development Goals is an ambitious one. In many ways, it's a sort of normative framework of moral giants, you could argue. I mean, it's true that even if we reach many of the MDGs, there'll still be a lot of people living in poverty. There'll still be a lot of children beneath the age of five dying each year. There'll still be a lot of children out of school. But these are hugely ambitious goals in relation to what has been achieved in the past. And then we ask the critical question of what's the delivery against these goals? And frankly, it's the delivery record of dwarves. It's the delivery record of a community that isn't serious about the goals that it's embraced and makes a great public relations job of portraying at international summits and global meetings. And I guess the starting point of what I want to say is really to ask people to reflect on this huge gap between normative statement on the one side and achievement on the other, because I think it's that gap which is at the heart of the problem that we're talking about. And if we think about the concrete manifestation of that gap and what it means in practice, there are some, I think, fairly stark illustrations. That if you ask Pascal Lamy, the European Union Trade Commissioner, whether he believed in the Millennium Development Goals, he will wax lyrical about them and tell you how profoundly important they are and how they guide his every moment of thinking in his waking day. If you ask him to reform the common agricultural sugar regime in order to accelerate progress towards the Millennium Development Goals, you'll get an equivalent of, you must be joking. Yeah. If you ask European Union governments, why don't you apply the same principles to your shareholder rights in the International Monetary Fund when it comes to fiscal policy as you apply to yourselves with the abandonment of the Growth and Fiscal Stability Pact, they'll tell you this is a different issue, that Ethiopia, Tanzania have to operate on different fiscal approaches than the European Union. So there's a stark gap between what the European Union is projecting onto the international stage and what it says it's doing in relation to the Millennium Development Goals. In the case of the United States, you see exactly the same gap. The Bush administration, of course, is in favour of the Millennium Development Goals, provided it doesn't have to take anything away from the membership of the National Cotton Council, provided that it doesn't have to surrender Wall Street control over the International Monetary Fund approaches to debt relief in Latin America, and so on. And this is again, is a very stark gap between normative statement and substantive policy. Transnational companies love the Millennium Development Goals. You know, they keep writing to us in Oxfam and asking us to go and have meetings with them and sign statements with them about our shared commitment to the Millennium Development Goals. But of course, they're in favour of the Millennium Development Goals, provided they don't impinge on their intellectual property rights. And they're in favour of the Millennium Development Goals, provided interventions regarding them are restricted to voluntary frameworks on things like codes of conduct and labour rights, and not to statutory obligations on them. And of course, Southern governments love to talk about Millennium Development Goals, provided you don't link it to discussions about the redistribution of land, the redistribution of public spending, and other such factors. And it does seem to me that we've got into this really bad habit of, when we talk about this gap between the normative framework on the one side and the actual achievement on the other, we use the word political will. You know, if only governments had the political will to close this gap. And of course, you know, at one level that's right. You know, we're all in favour of more political will. It's like motherhood and apple pie and the Articles of the American Constitution and that sort of thing, that you can't be opposed to it. But governments don't lack political will. Governments make choices. They choose to do what they do. In a resource-constrained world, they decide how to allocate resources. And they do it on the basis of power relationships, of judgments about power, and about judgments about the maintenance of control over global institutions. So it strikes me, first of all, that we're not actually dealing with a failure of political will. We're dealing with a failure of political choice. And we need to understand what guides the political choices that are leading, as Anne pointed out very starkly, to this growing gap between the targets that have been set under the MDGs and the actual achievements. The second thing to say by way of introductory remark is that we can't ignore the broader context in which this discussion is taking place. And without wanting to be unduly provocative, in David's sense, but without wanting to be unduly provocative, I think the broader context is one of a concerted assault on the central principles of multilateralism. And that assault is at its starkest in the security field, with the principles, the central principles of the Bush-Rumsfeld doctrine of preemption, aggressive confrontation of countries on the basis of ill-defined security criteria, of a willingness to circumvent and undermine the United Nations where it's perceived to be in the strategic interests of the United States to do that. And that approach applies not just to the security field, but I think you see a spillover effect in international trade. And I think you saw it in the fallout of Cancun, with very clear statements from Robert Zoellick of greater or lesser degree of sophistication, but which could all be preceded with a general remark of the WTO can go to hell, that the United States does not need the WTO, that the United States is quite capable of negotiating bilateral agreements and regional agreements that correspond to US strategic commercial interests. If the WTO facilitates United States strategic goals. It will embrace the principles of the WTO and participate in negotiations. But if the multilateral system doesn't do that, it can be circumvented, avoided, and so on. And so we're heading towards, on the side of the most powerful player in the equation, a sort of multilateralism of convenience. We'll support the multilateral system as long as it supports what we happen to define at the moment as our strategic interest. This is the opposite of what a global governance system ought to be doing. The global governance system, as it was designed after the Second World War, was really about trying to establish some sort of system of universal rules that would apply something like the rule of law to everybody, that would prevent the arbitrary use and abuse of power. And of course, it's very easy for Europeans to point the finger at the United States on this, but in many ways, the greatest tragedy of this whole story is the abject failure of Europe to mount an effective response. And by that, I don't just mean this sort of post-Robert Kagan debate over the willingness or otherwise of Europe to assert military power in other parts of the world, but the failure of Europe to assert a security and development project onto the international stage. The European Union countries together are the biggest voting group in the Bretton Woods institutions. But what is a European project in the Bretton Woods institutions? I mean, just the short answer is that there isn't one. There's a British position, a French position, a German position, and that, I think, has been deeply damaging. So there are two introductory thoughts. Why does all this matter? And I think it matters for precisely the reasons that Anne very eloquently set out. It's almost platitudinous to say this, but we do live in an increasingly interdependent world, that something fundamentally has changed over the last 20 years. People have argued and debated over the extent to which globalization marks a break with the past and whether we're more globalized now than we were 100 years ago. But I think the bottom line is that in most fundamental respects, we are. We're linked by the great forces driving globalization of trade and investment, the exchange of ideas and communications, but we're also increasingly linked by common problems, by the problem of global poverty, by the problem of rising inequality, by environmental crises, by insecurity, by war and refugee flows. And these are not problems which lend themselves to national solutions. They are, by definition, international problems which demand international cooperation in response to them. And that implies some system of international governance. And I think that's nowhere is that more apparent than in relation to the Millennium Development Goals. And I think realistically, one has to say that it's absolutely clear that they're, well, one, the Millennium Development Goals are clearly going to be missed. So that's a sort of starting point. The real question is by how much they're going to be missed. And that will, in part and in large measure, be a function of the international effort in areas like resource mobilization, changing international trade rules, changing the rules that govern the management of international debt problems and environmental problems, and so on. Now, what do we mean by the notion of global governance? David, in the book that he wrote with Anthony McGrew, I think comes up with quite a neat definition of the sort of governance structure that we're talking about in the global system, which he refers to as a sort of thickening web of institutions, agreements, treaties, that if you take them in composite, to a greater or lesser degree, manage the relationships between governments. But if you start disentangling that web, there are a lot of different component parts of it. Some parts of it are of pretty ancient vintage, dating back to the League of Nations, like the International Labour Organization, the central body in the global governance system still, for protecting labour rights, defunct as it may be in practical terms. The economic governance system is still, by and large, in the hands of the institutions that were created as part of the Bretton Woods settlement, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. In the 1990s, we've seen a whole raft of new measures, bilateral investment treaties and trade treaties, regional trade agreements, environmental treaties, and so on. But I guess the starkest feature to emerge from this model is that we've got something profoundly new and revolutionary happening in international economic and political relationships between governments under globalization. And we're trying to manage it through a sort of ad hoc jigsaw of governance structures that have been handed down, amended, and grafted onto this new set of economic relationships. And one of the basic problems that we're dealing with is that it doesn't fit. The WTO was created to address the trade problem, the GATT, the predecessor of the WTO, was created to deal with a very different set of trade problems than the world is trying to deal with today, and similarly for the International Monetary Fund and for the World Bank. But it does strike me that we can get bogged down too heavily in some of the institutional questions that relate to global governance. And it seems to me that this, to go back to where I started, that the central issue that we really have to address is the question of power relationships within this governance structure. Why does this governance structure deliver what it delivers? Why does it operate in the way that it does? And I think to answer that question, you have to start by critically reviewing what really are the two central pillars of any governance structure, which are the rules, and by the rules I mean the substantive policies of the system itself, and the process, by which I mean the institutions and the representational structures that they embody. And the proposition that I want to make is that both the rules and the political structures are actually designed to produce precisely the outcome in relation to the Millennium Development Goals. The rules are rigged against poor countries and in favour of rich countries, and that provides part of the explanation for why the benefits of globalization accrue disproportionately to rich countries and not to poor countries. And the reason that the institutions are able to do that is by and large because they're governed by rich countries on their own behalf to produce precisely those outcomes. Or more accurately, I should say, not on their own behalf, but on their behalf and on behalf of the powerful vested interests that guide their policies in those institutions. And what I'd like to do is just to give some a few examples from areas like trade and development financing, and to start off in both cases with just some very simple observations about democratic structures. If we take the World Trade Organization as a starting point, in many ways the World Trade Organization is a sort of model for global governance. This is a consensus-based organization. It's not like the IMF and the World Bank, where your voting power is a reflection of your purchasing power in the global economy for practical purposes. In fact, I think there are hardly ever any votes in the WTO. So this is ostensibly a consensus-based organization. What that means in practice has really been graphically illustrated for me in the context of the cotton case at the WTO. And we in Oxfam have been doing a lot of work with West African governments on cotton. And just to give you an illustration of what we're talking about, we've been helping them with a couple of other organizations on the economic analysis of the impact of US cotton subsidies. They've had two law firms working for them part-time on a pro bono basis. And they've been confronted with endless rafts of econometric data produced by the rent-a-professor contingency used by the US Department of Agriculture to assert that there is in fact no damage caused to Africa by US cotton subsidies, by some of the top law firms in international trade in America. Now, this is a very unequal arrangement here. And this isn't to mention the arm twisting that's been going on behind the scenes, which is about linking the cotton case to aid flows and debt relief and other such factors. So there is a very stark example of the sort of abuse of power that we're talking about. But then when you go beyond the democratic structure and ask about the rules, look at agriculture. I mean, if you want trade to become a dynamic force for poverty reduction, agriculture, in a sense, is where you have to start. After all, 3/4 of all people who live on less than a dollar a day in the developing world live and work in rural areas, mostly as small farmers. There's extensive evidence that the structure of subsidies in Europe and North America damage their livelihoods. And yet, in the WTO, you have a system of rules. It's called the green box for anybody who wants to go and pursue this in the context of dissertations, which basically allow the European Union and the United States to subsidize. and to dump their products on the world market without violating WTO rules. It's an interesting fact, as Robert Zelig has pointed out to me on more than one occasion, that the US does not give a single cent in export subsidies in cotton, as defined by the WTO. The US might export cotton at one third of the cost of production, if you use US Department of Agriculture data, but it doesn't give subsidies in the sense defined by the WTO. And the reason for that is very simple, which is the United States and the European Union wrote the rules. So you have one set of rules for the United States and Europe and another set of rules for poor countries. On market access, you have some of the world's poorest countries facing the highest tariff barriers in the United States and the European Union. And on the other side, you have both Europe and the United States pushing a very hard bargain at the WTO for developing countries themselves to accelerate the rate at which they're opening their markets. This, mind you, is supposed to be a development round. It was a round launched just after September the 11th, when all the rhetoric was about sharing the benefits of globalization with poor countries and so on. And in the 2 years between the Doha Declaration, which launched that round, and Cancun, I can't think of a single substantive initiative that came out of Europe or North America that would actually have done something to make trade work for the poor. If you want to understand why international trade isn't a more dynamic force for reducing poverty in developing countries, just look at the rules. It's a very simple story. Intellectual property rights. I know that the corporate community love to tell us about how they share Oxfam's concerns and the concerns of the wider community about poverty reduction in developing countries. But if you look at the rules governing intellectual property rights and patents on medicines, even under the reformed regime of the WTO, it's absolutely clear that this is going to raise the price of essential medicines for poor people in poor countries, that it's going to have catastrophic consequences for health, for child mortality, and for the Millennium Development Goals. And yet there isn't a constituency out there trying to change these rules anymore. That battle has been lost. And I think it's worth just standing back and saying that's, maybe I've overstated the case in some respects. But surely the real question here is we have to ask, who are the constituencies that are pulling the strings that make northern governments behave in this way at the World Trade Organization? And it does strike me, as a development community, we haven't really addressed that question in a serious way. There's no point bemoaning the fact that the US doesn't play fair on subsidies. What we need to do is to understand how can you marginalize the National Cotton Council and the Wheat Growers Federation of America domestically in order to create a domestic political process in which it becomes possible for the United States to act on the principle that it says it embraces through the Millennium Development Goals. Turning to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, Anne has already alluded to this, that there is something...
In just 2 minutes.
Right? 2 minutes, sure. There is, it seems to be, something fundamentally wrong if you look at the operations of the International Monetary Fund in low-income countries. That the countries affected themselves, sub-Saharan Africa, account for something like 2% of the votes in the International Monetary Fund. The United States, I think, accounts for something like 17%. Now, this is a rather perverse form of shareholder democracy. And I think it highlights one of the central problems in governance structures within the global system, that as power has passed upwards from national governments to global institutions, we haven't elaborated a representational democracy structure that enables the governments themselves to be answerable to their citizens. For practical purposes, the government of Ethiopia does not set the fiscal framework for Ethiopia, but it's answerable to the people of Ethiopia for that framework. And so there's a basic disjuncture and discrepancy there. I was going to say something about the corporate sector, but I'll just make one very brief observation on that. It seems to me that one of the governance issues there is this, that the corporate sector is investing huge amounts, much to the joy of Price Waterhouse and other companies, in codes of conduct and the auditing of their activities. And I think most people who have looked at this objectively will say that, yes, there have been some benefits, but frankly, it hasn't made a great deal of difference. But on the other side of the equation that some of the business models that are emerging under globalization of just-in-time delivery and passing risk back down the supply chain are clearly being translated into increased pressure on labor standards. And so you have a discrepancy between the principles in corporate codes of conduct and the corporate business model itself. And it does seem to me this is one area that isn't really being fundamentally addressed. So, by way of conclusion, less than 1 minute now, I guess, I think the conclusion is this. Less talk about failures of political will, more talk about power in international relationships, more talk about the vested interests who drive European and US policy at the WTO and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and critically, the mobilization of the coalitions domestically that can change those power relationships. So I'll leave it there. Thanks, David.
Well, if you want to leave before the discussion, it might quickly slip out. Well, I thought Kevin was going to be provocative, and but one thing he certainly was bleak. And it seemed to me that the portrayal of power, power relations, rule structures, and processes that he sets out is a very, very pessimistic one, which shows relatively few places for optimism and progressive policy development. It seemed to me Anne was probably the most optimistic when she argued that some of the deep drivers of globalization, information technology, spread of ideas of democracy and human rights, issues to do with the growth of civil society and so on, are leading in a direction which gives in the long run more hope for change if one's concerned with poverty, welfare, the environment, and so on. I think it's important to remember that social change does take a long time. I always say to my students, if you think that when the idea of the modern state was first promulgated in the late 16th century by people like Hobbes, Locke, and so on, it took nearly 250 to 300 years for this idea of a modern state to become entrenched across the world. I think political change has since become easier, but economic change and substantial changes in economic processes is still enormously difficult to bring off. So I was going to ask them each to comment on each other for 5 minutes, but time has slipped on and I'm writing the rules, so I'm going to change them. What I'd like them each to do is just to take 1 minute and make us, if possible, a little happier. Given the Millennium Goals, what is the most important thing you think could be done to ease the development towards those goals now? And secondly, do you think there's any hope in hell of that happening? 1 minute each, and then the floor.
And I start. Right. In 1 minute, I'm going to throw out something I'm not sure I believe in the interest of provoking a discussion, which is that the Bush administration is doing us all a big favor through its concerted attack on multilateralism and multilateral institutions, because it's taking institutions that are highly problematic for a whole series of reasons and making it clear that they are not going to work, and therefore we'd better come up with some other and better systems. Maybe a WTO that permits things like agricultural subsidies and CAP to continue ought to go to hell. Maybe Zelig has a point. And if that's the case, then it's incumbent on everybody who cares about global issues and global governance to say, not to spend their time blaming the Bush administration for deciding to bypass such institutions, actually the Europeans are doing some of the same, particularly in the economic area, but to think about, if those aren't the institutions we can or should have, what do we have instead? And that gets me to thinking a lot about what's the role of civil society, what is incumbent on all of us in this room who are aware of these issues, who are well-educated, and who are in a position to be quite a bit more active than most of us are. What are our responsibilities?
I'd hate to have to take one of your exams because that was an extremely tough question you posed. There is no magic bullet.
I'm a soft marker.
This is such a multidimensional and complex issue, but you asked us, you know, what's the one thing that really could help push things forward? And I think I said at one point in my talk that I was skeptical about the lack of resources being a really binding constraint here.
and rather what I think is more of a lack of imagination with respect to resources. And you know, the price tag, $50 billion incremental for the development part of the Millennium Goals that's been bandied about seems daunting. But in other contexts, it really doesn't seem like that much money at all when you look at some of the costs of weapons systems. The problem from my perspective there is that people have proposed kind of magic bullets like a Tobin tax or a tax on arms. These things don't have a political chance in hell, frankly, of coming to pass by and large. And the discussion has kind of stopped there. And what if you ask me, well, the one thing that I think could help push us forward, it would be to have a little more serious, intellectually rigorous look at the resource question. And from my standpoint, if you get out of the sort of panacea mode and you get into more of a practical calculus, you look at IMF Gold, where we've already crossed that bridge to help fund the expanded HIPC program. There's already there's still on the books a huge difference in the book value and the market value of the gold holdings of the IMF just sitting there. And Lord knows we don't have too much liquidity in the world right now. Secondly, greater gearing of the MDBs, of the multilateral development banks, which are very conservatively geared and could actually mobilize much more resources if we thought about it a little bit more. If we were a little more imaginative on the new vehicles for tapping private markets and mitigating risk by bundling risk in some fashions. Bilateral aid, there's scope. We've already seen some movement here, but you can't put it all on the back of bilateral aid. And clearly debt relief has way more to go. I think our structure, and I can speak with a little bit of authority on this, having been involved in the Cologne summit discussions and developing the expanded HIPC rules and whatnot, and bucking from within on this, it's very clear that there's way more scope to go on the debt sustainability calculations there. Basically, the bottom line is that we need a more composite approach to thinking about the resource gap here. And if we thought more politically and also a little more rigorously intellectually about some of these issues, we might be able to pull together a package that would give a bit of a push to the process.
Thank you. He didn't understand the exam brief, just one item. Mm. That was four, but
it's a reason
they were compelling points.
No, I agree with Richard. It's a very cruel question.
I'm going to answer it in a minute.
I sort of disagree with Anne in the sense that I think we get the global institutions, and by which I mean European and American governments, we get the global institutions that our governments want. And we have to make them want different institutions. And I think there are some areas where we have made them want to make these institutions work very differently. And I think the debt campaign is a very stark example of that, that in the space of 2 or 3 years, we really pushed that issue onto the agenda and achieved a very substantive change in policy. And to some degree, we did it in education. To some degree, it's happened in health with the Global HIV AIDS Fund. But I think this is partly about going back to basics in the political sphere, that these changes will only happen if we can mobilize the political coalitions that make them happen. And I've been very struck recently. I've been reading a book about the Corn Law League in Britain in the 1830s. And in those days, nobody spoke about political will. They spoke about how landlords are ripping off workers and mobilized trade unions and others to change that. And I sort of think we have to start doing that, of really focusing much more on where the political obstacles are to achieving change and mobilizing the coalitions that that can remove them. And I think, you know, in broad terms, what we see if you look at civil society and others, we've got a lot of sort of segmented campaigns going on. We've got campaigns on debt, we've got campaigns on education, we've got campaigns on health, and we sort of need a concerted global campaign on poverty that addresses these questions of trade and the mobilization of resources in a much more integrated way than we've done so far.
Well, I think there's all three compelling responses. A plus is for all of you. I would just add something complimentary, which seems to me, I was once asked if you could name just one reform of the global government system, what would it be? And I said, slightly tongue-in-cheek, electoral reform in the United States, especially of campaign financing. Because it seems to me, unless that issue is fundamentally addressed, some of the great imbalances of power and of policy are unlikely to get sustained support in the most powerful country in the world. But do I think that's likely to happen, to answer the second part of the question? Highly unlikely in the short term. Now, questions. We're running late. We've taken it 7:30, but if you're relatively happy to be here for another 20 minutes or so, I'll see by how many of you walk out. We'll take questions in clusters of five, And to give you, I'm going to stand over here so I can see you all. And why doesn't the, why don't we start with five down here, and then we'll go upstairs for five more. Keep the questions brief.
This is for Ms. Florini. I was wondering if you are, if you know about the World Federalist Association, and if the institute has done, the institution has done any work with them regarding this.
That was brief. Yes, down here.
Yes, I was surprised that no one talked really about the multilateral corporations and the way they are able to flaunt the world rules.
You mean multilateral? You mean multinational corporations?
Yes, not corporations. That they are able to avoid paying taxes to national governments and send the profits to the shareholders. And I was wondering if that reform isn't absolutely essential.
Well, I would like just to ask all of you is like the key players in the world are like the states are no members of the Kyoto Protocol, no member of the International Criminal Court. They are using the IMF to protect the financial interests, and they use protectionism to protect their own industries. So don't you think that this is going to create kind of a reaction from developing countries, and probably all of these beautiful contests of global governance is going to kind of collapse because they go believing that there is going to be, well, they have faith on that, and they see that it's kind of, well, not going anywhere.
Should we try the other side of the room for a moment? I'm afraid the selection process is always somewhat arbitrary. The only rule I have is gender balance. But geographic balance in such a big room is hard to sustain. Just, yes. Lady there, did you have your hand up? Yeah.
I just wanted to know what you thought about the concept of developing a more significant feeling of global citizenship. I think at one point, Kevin Watkins was saying that governments don't lack political will, government make political choices. But governments make political choices in function of the electorate, of citizens, of private people like ourselves, but most of all in function of consumers. And I think we're all consumers. And I don't think that when one talks about governments, one talks much about the concept of global citizenship. I think that as citizens of the world, it doesn't seem clear to all of us what our choices ought to be. I think I read a statistic once that if the world was to pollute entirely at today's level, but equally, i.e. everybody in the world would pollute the same amount, but we would keep the same level of pollution, I think we would all be entitled to one transatlantic flight per in our lifetime, just to show how much we all in the industrialized world pollute. And so I just think that the concept of global citizenship really needs to be enhanced, because we're the ones that are consuming, we're the ones that are polluting, and we're the ones that are ultimately electing governments. I don't think the choices that we've got are very defined. I think we really don't have very many choices in the system that we're
clear question
in.
Now. In so the interest of sorry, citizenship, pass, can so you just pass the mic around? No, that's fine. It's a clear question. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to question there's a basic premise of really unites the panelists as I see it, and that is the notion that the problems of the developing world can really be laid at the doorstep of the developed world. Now, I'm not denying that there's a lot of validity in what's been said today, but at the same time, it's clear to me that there's a huge variety between different developing countries. Some developing countries have done extremely well, and China is quoted in your report. Poverty has fallen greatly in China, yet it's still subject to the same sort of international trading regime as other countries that have done disastrously. I would just like to hear some comments from the panelists on that phenomenon.
Thank you. Are you happy? If I give you just a minute each, will you just pick up the questions you think were most sharply focused at you? I'd like you just to be brief, though, so that these can't be thorough answers, they can only be indicative, because I'd like to get more people.
Sure. Okay, on the question on the World Federalist, I've actually given a whole series of book talks to World Federalist groups, and have not found that the kinds of things that they are thinking about in terms of, they're still promoting the idea of world government, which is an idea that I find basically unworkable and unreasonable. On the MNCs, they don't flaunt the rules, they make them, and that's a large part of the problem. On key countries not being part of global government agreements, is that going to spur a backlash? Yes, of course, it's already happening. On global citizenship, that's where I want to spend most of my minute. I actually have a chapter in my book that is entirely on the question of citizenship and identity, and how it is that we have thought about identity, because that's what determines what collectivity you think you're part of, and therefore what interests matter to you, and what your interests are. That's how people define what they care about and what interests they're going to pursue. There's a series of polls that have been done over how people identify themselves, and the one encouraging thing that I find is that over the generations, there's a marked shift in how people identify themselves. They, if you take older generations right now, they tend to identify themselves primarily in local terms and to a lesser degree in national terms. The younger you go, the more down the generational cohort you go, the sharper the shift is toward thinking of identity in at least regional and very often in global terms. So I think this question of how do you spur a sense of global citizenship, global identity, I think we need to do a lot more than has already been done. But I think the shift in general is already underway, and I find that a very encouraging sign. Very briefly on the problems of developing countries can't be laid at the feet of developing countries, obviously true, but this is a discussion about global governance where the rules and the implementation are dominated by the rich countries and therefore our focus is on them.
Maybe I'll, since you've touched some of the other questions, maybe I'll pick up the question about, for lack of a better term, revolt by developing countries in response to inequitable, what's perceived as inequitable behavior by the North. And, you know, I think we, much of what unites your question and much of what Kevin has talked about here is, you know, what are the political pressure points that will promote serious action here? And advising, you know, politicians, much of your work kind of comes about looking through that prism, trying to find what's going to be in their political interest to actually do something. And when Seattle was a bust, when, you know, the Doha round really couldn't get launched for quite a while because it was clear the developing countries were agitating collectively in a way that was shocking, frankly, relative to previous rounds of multilateral trade negotiations, that in a way was a shock to the political system. And so you could argue that it already in some cases it's begun, it has happened, and it has an impact. And that's why I dwell a little bit on this issue of trying to get coherence, build institutional arrangements that force coherence, number one, that get people thinking beyond their portfolios, and number two, make them accountable to people who are directly accountable to electors at the leader level. Because those people are much more sensitive to popular opinion domestically and internationally than others. And so I think the combination of some dawning of consciousness about this on the part of developing countries with maybe some institutional changes could help in this respect. And the last thing I'll say in this respect is, you know, this point about you made about the electoral financing system in the United States. I mean, that is a factor. It goes to some of the stuff that Kevin was talking about. If you're trying to figure out what makes the system tick and make it so rigid for change, it is in part because the people who get hurt by trade tend to get very well organized. It's an axiom of trade politics, at least where I've come out of, that the people who are hit negatively by integration by trade tend to speak the loudest, and the benefits, on the other hand, are much more diffuse, and therefore don't take the form of a really concerted political action. And the issue is, how do you work around that? In the debt relief campaign, and I'll end here, what happened was not so much only a developing country banding together and saying this is an absurd system, although there was significant amounts of that, but it was mobilizing elements of the polity in the North that could make a difference, which was principally the religious community, I would say. They were very, very important, but also any poverty groups like Oxfam and others. But this interesting confluence of that and the fact that it was, people began to realize that health and education, you can't really make progress unless you have budgetary resources on some of the fundamental building blocks of education. And when you looked at the numbers, it didn't add up if they were to pay their debts. So
okay.
That, some thoughts about your question about how you mobilize action.
Kevin, 1 minute.
Yeah, 1 minute. Well, very, very briefly. Transnational companies, I think there's a general issue in debates on trade at the moment, which is that there's too much maths from economists and not enough political economy. And if you want to understand why the US and why the EU do what they do at the WTO, you need to understand political economy and who the corporate groups are, who for practical purposes write their trade policies in very many areas. So I think that is an absolutely critical area. On developing countries' reaction, I think this is a really important point. And if there's one really positive thing that comes out of Cancun, is that you had three African governments who said no to the United States on cotton. And you had the group of four, China, Brazil, South Africa, and India, really mobilizing an effective coalition and drawing a line in the sand over agriculture and investment and other issues. And I think that has started to shift the political dynamic in the WTO in a really important way. Citizenship. I agree with that. I haven't read the chapter of her book yet, which I'm looking forward to reading. But I guess the trouble with citizenship is it's also a sort of double-edged sword. And if you look at what happens in elections, I mean, if you look at what's happening in the run-up to the US election now, anyone who wants to bring an anti-dumping suit against China can do it with impunity, because that's good for votes. It's not as though democracy and citizenship actually results in the poor necessarily being empowered, either at a global level or at a national level. And, you know, France, the home of these notions of citizenships, would not deprive the Paris Basin cereals growing fraternity of their right to collect subsidies in the interest of protecting the rights of poor people in developing countries. And it's difficult to see any notion of citizenship that is going to change that dynamic. I mean, this comes back to the question of power, I think. On developing countries, you're absolutely right. My defense is the same as Anne's. This is a discussion about global governance. But I think it's interesting. There's been a summit in Latin America this week on governance. And the agenda has been entirely about transparency and accountability. The word distribution and taxation, to the best of my knowledge, has yet to appear in that summit. And it does strike me, for governments that are serious about poverty reduction and inequality, that is absolutely not acceptable. And it raises very fundamental questions about how governments in Latin America are looking at their own obligations and their own responsibilities in relation to their citizens.
Right, I'm aware that time is getting on, and some of you look like you're ready to leave. Let's just say there'll be one more round of brief questions, even briefer answers, but those who want to go now should quickly go, just so we don't have constant leakage. And if you could just do it, well, it's a turn of the top floor to have five questions, let's say 30 seconds each, and very brief responses. Okay, where's the mic? Okay, why don't we start beside, yeah.
Hi, I just want to bring up one of the points that Kevin Watkins was talking about multilateralism of convenience. If states are going to continue to act on their own vested interests and look after number one, how valid is the term global governance, and how far can we say that there is any sort of global governance?
Okay, thank you. Gentleman here who's with us standing up.
Workable and working global instruments. We have one of those in the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises, which were substantially revised for the millennium. And I think the Oxfam deserves congratulations and support for the professional and competent way they participated in that revision. But what strikes me as very unusual is you have a large number of interest groups who want global justice. These guidelines are rarely, if ever, mentioned in the media, and they're rarely, if ever, used in practice. And each member state of the OECD has a national contact point that can be used. And I'm wondering, why is there an instrument but not active follow-up by civil society?
Thank you. Lady at the back, and then the microphone will have to come over.
Claire O'Brien from the Human Rights Centre at LSE. Kevin mentioned and criticised a couple of times during his comments voluntary corporate initiatives. to improve corporate conduct and implement human rights and so on, and referred to objective studies that had sort of assessed their relative effectiveness. So I just wondered if you could tell us what those were, because it's an area I'm interested in, and I haven't been able to find really any objective studies assessing sort of how effective they are relative to other forms of regulation.
Who was it? Next one here? Yeah. Okay.
The Global Governance Initiative. How has this report been received, and are you going to do one this year?
Hi. I just wanted to ask, I think it's quite easy to dismiss the multinational corporations, but I don't think they're one homogenous mass. So while TRIPS favors the drug companies, it doesn't help mining companies in South Africa that have 40% of their workforce HIV positive. So if there is a positive role for multinationals to play, what should they be doing to influence this problem of political will and governance?
Okay, finally, the gentleman up there. Yeah, this is the sixth question, so, but you're looking very needy.
No, I would just like to ask, would you suggest that there actually exists some kind of a tacit agreement among the leading countries to maintain a certain global order based on this notion of neo-imperialism with respect to international trade?
Thank you. I'm sorry if I haven't come to you, but I think we have run out of time for more questions. So do you want just 30 seconds each? No.
No, I want a full minute.
I know you'll
minute.
Take a minute, so I'm saying 30 seconds. If I say a minute, you'll take two. So 30 seconds.
So well, the question is, how fast can we talk? I'm going to say a few seconds about each. Yes, states act in their vested interests. Of course they do. They always will. The question is, how do we change how they define what their interests are? As Kevin said, on developing constituencies, that is the key. The OECD guidelines, they are just one of a whole series of efforts at laying out guidelines for the behavior of multinational corporations, and we badly need not only for them to be more focused on, but for that whole series of initiatives to get together and start developing some coherence. On this whole question of voluntary corporate initiatives and multinational corporations are not homogeneous, and how do we think about them across the board, and how do we assess them, there's a chapter in my book. You want the quick answer, I'll give that to you after the session. How's the report been received? Haven't a clue. Today was the day we released it. Yes, we are going to be doing this next year. This is meant to be an annual accountability exercise. Is there a tacit agreement among the world's leading governments? At this point, I don't think there's a tacit agreement among the world's leading governments on any subject whatsoever. Whether that will change in the future remains to be seen.
Briefly.
Yeah. I will not answer any of the questions that Anne answered. I'll just maybe try to tackle this. What should multinational corporations do to try to influence this lack of so-called lack of political will? I think it's not just to write a check and be a philanthropist. And I think more and more companies are coming to that recognition, and that they're viewing corporate citizenship, still a small proportion perhaps of the international business community, but more and more are coming to realize that it's twofold. One is to basically apply what assets they have that have a particular comparative advantage to plug into a problem, whether it be the skills of their workforce, their distribution system, the particular assets in their industrial sector. And that is what I see as an encouraging sign we try to foster. The second is much more poorly developed, and that is to have a sense that they have a stake in more enlightened international governance, and therefore try to help break down those silos that I referred to earlier and get engaged in some of the debates about these policy issues and play a constructive role and to help out on capacity building, because the private sector is where the expertise resides in some of these areas. So that's an agenda. It's not exactly being fully fulfilled, but it's got potential.
Very briefly, I think on the issue of multilateralism, I was probably a bit black and white in my presentation, but I think that there's a tension in multilateralism, and the tension is partly that governments wanting to use the multilateral system to advance their own interests, and partly recognizing that they need some sort of multilateral system in their interest, and these two things pull in very different directions in different contexts. And At the moment, I think the balance has clearly swung in the direction of northern governments in particular using the multilateral system to advance their own interests rather than trying to advance the global public good, as it were. On labour markets, There are a couple of reports that we've done that I could refer you to that document this. One of them is a chapter of our trade report, which is on that. And we've got two reports coming out, one on sports companies and one on the fruit and vegetable sector, which looks at the way in which codes of conduct have been administered in some detail. And actually, one of the best things I've seen on this recently is the internal Walmart assessment of its own administration of its own code of conduct, which basically says that none of its managers have heard of it, and those that have don't take it seriously. So I think there is a lot of evidence out there, but you can look at those reports that I've mentioned, which will refer you to the specific cases. On transnational companies, I agree again. I don't think this is black and white, and I think in some areas, somebody mentioned the case of HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa, that clearly some of the mining companies are doing very important things. But it does strike me that the private sector has huge responsibilities in the global market. That, you know, the private sector is the gatekeeper to new technologies, it's the gatekeeper to markets, it's the gatekeeper for skills that countries need in order to benefit from globalization. So I do think it's a really critical area. And I think in some of those areas, the companies tend towards the pursuit of short-run profit rather than a sort of long-term assessment of what's in their best interest, let alone the interests of the global community. Whether or not the US and the EU are sitting down talking about neo-imperialism, I doubt that they use the word neo-imperialism.
Well, it wasn't one of those days. I was wrong. It was an excellent day and a terrific panel. Thank you very much.